So, what it means to be human, I think that's what I'm supposed to be talking about. What it means, it sort of sounds an odd phrase, doesn't it? Because it implies that perhaps we could be something else. And of course for our Western views, and certainly even our Christian views or other religious views, that's an unlikely possibility, you know. We are simply who we are. But according to Buddhism, it actually does imply, according to Buddhism, in fact, each living being has this consciousness, this mind or consciousness, that has potential to manifest in different aspects. It's a simple way to say it. So the Buddhist idea is we are at this moment in time definitely human, but our consciousness didn't begin with this conception at the time of conception of this life, and certainly won't end at the end of this life. That in fact, you know, this human life is the context for this. I mean, there are ways of actually, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there are ways of contemplating what they talk about as being the preciousness of this life, to really use this life. Because, so by contemplating how it's very precious, and that we've actually created the cause to be a human, this is the context for it, and so maybe we should talk about that. So this consciousness we have, this mind, is the non-physical part of us. And in Buddhist terms, it's not created by some superior being called God or Buddha. It doesn't just come from our parents. And as I said, doesn't just begin at the time of conception and doesn't end at the time of death. This consciousness we have actually is, in Buddhist terms, is beginningless. It's a beginningless continuity of energy. And according to the concept of karma, this is something that's pretty fundamental to the Buddhist ideas, karma, we've actually created the cause from past actions for our consciousness to go into the womb of this new mother, the mother of this life, and for us to manifest as a human, having the qualities of a human. And it's exactly the same in Buddhist terms, it's exactly the same for any living being, a scorpion, an ant, whatever types of beings exist. They're not just random kind of creatures. They're not made by some superior being or by God, by Buddha. They're not just coming just from their own side. They're each of them a manifestation of their own past energy. It's a very simple way of saying it. So in Buddhist terms, if you want to talk about a creator, you can say that each of us is actually the creator of who we are ourselves in the long-term sense, you know, in an evolutionary sense, that we are the fruit of past actions. In the same way that from moment to moment, Buddhism is saying, you know, we are the fruit of even of yesterday and the day before. So if we spend our life being angry, don't be surprised that you become an angry person, you know, or that you create constant problems for yourself and attract difficulties. So how we are, how we think, how we act in the short term and the long term is this really fundamental idea of karma in Buddhism, which is pretty central. It's absolutely central, in fact, to the Buddhist ideas. So what's the point of thinking this way? You know, I mean, what is the implication? Really, the implication of this is actually the Buddhist idea that we are responsible. We are responsible for our own happiness, and we are responsible for our own suffering. This is really the essence of it, and this implies practice. The point of practice is through understanding that our own thoughts, our own feelings, our own emotions actually produce our own experiences, and that we are the ones who are ultimately responsible for whether we're happy or whether we suffer. And that one of the particular characteristics in Buddhist terms of being a human is that we have the ability to really make choices. This is probably the unique characteristic of having a human body, a human life, a human consciousness, which in Buddhist terms we have actually created the cause to have. One of the unique characteristics is that we can make choices. And this is the most precious thing. Because what Buddhism is saying is ultimately every living being within their consciousness possesses the potential to be perfect. You can say, if you like, the end result of Buddhist practice. According to Buddhism, the result that one is, you know, unfolding is the perfection of enlightenment, so-called Buddhahood, this word Buddha, Sanskrit word that just really means fully awakened. And according to Buddhism, this is actually the natural state of who we are. This is our ultimate potential. This is, in a sense, it's a way of saying it's who we actually are. So our job, if you like, is to unfold, to discover this potential of perfection. And the most simple way of saying that, it means simply the full development of what we call positive qualities. That's all a Buddha is. Infinitely developed love, compassion, wisdom, kindness, these qualities, which we all know about, we all see them in ourselves. And as the absolute elimination of the opposite, anger, jealousy, pride, attachment. And this is one of the things that Buddhism is saying. And that as a human, we have all the characteristics, we have the capacity to be able to actually achieve this. And that actually to be a human, and this is something kind of, certainly in our usual concepts, we do not think like this at all. This is the Buddhist idea, that actually if we really understood how hard we must have worked at the practices of morality and virtue and kindness and generosity and patience and love and all the rest, to actually be who we are at this moment. That if, you know, as I said, we're not the result of some superior being, God or Buddha. We're not just some random result. It's not as if we just got kind of plonked here by our parents, which is the commonest way we think. I mean, if we're Christian, we think God put us here. If we're materialists, we think our mother and father made us. So we're the result of them, you know. In Buddhist terms, neither of these. In Buddhist terms, in fact, this body, this life, this person that we are, is the accumulation of phenomenal amount of past hard work, morality, kindness, virtue, positive energy, positive actions, positive thoughts, positive speech. But this is the concept of karma, cause and effect. This is the principle in Buddhism of, if you want to call creation, as I said, if anybody is a creator, each of us is the creator of who we are. You can say like this. So a very fundamental kind of contemplation that we do again and again and again is to simply contemplate again and again until we wake up to this fact. Contemplate the preciousness of this life. How, due to past morality, we have created the cause for our consciousness to go into the womb of the new mother, to be born into this situation with this life, these opportunities. In other words, it's no accident that we're not born at this moment. We're not in Kosovo at this moment suffering the way they are. There's no accident that we're not in a scorpion's body at this moment. There's no accident that we're not starving or crazy or a junkie. So not only do we have a human life, we have actually a reasonably good one. With a series of conditions that make practice conducive, you know, that are conducive to practice. And none of this is an accident, which is how we tend to feel. It definitely feels accidental, doesn't it? It feels random. It feels as if we have nothing to do with who we are. I got put here by someone else, God or my parents. It sounds a bizarre idea, actually, to think that I created the cause to be who I am. It seems like a weird idea, you know. How could I have created me, we think. Well, this is the Buddhist idea of karma. And that every moment, everything we do, say, and think is actually sowing seeds, it's a simple way of saying, leaving imprints, leaving kind of reverberations, imprints in our consciousness that will produce our future. So in a very real way, you can say, we are moulding ourselves from moment to moment. And that not a single thought or word or action that we do doesn't leave a result. This is a bizarre idea in Buddhist terms. It's like energy that can only bring a reaction. You know, every moment our mind is doing something. Every moment our speech and body are doing something on the basis of that mind. And all of these actions of body, speech and mind, and that's the meaning of the word karma, leave impressions on our consciousness that then will ripen as experiences today, tomorrow, next day, next life, next, so on, so on. This is the Buddhist idea. So for a Buddhist, being a human, having useful conditions, having a good life, being born to reasonable parents, having a reasonable life, having a reasonably sane mind, having reasonably good health, having a reasonable amount of money, not even being extreme in any of these, is something truly phenomenal. It's something to be truly rejoiced about, and it's something not to be wasted. That's the final point. But we don't think this way at all, do we? I mean, we might actually. Some of us might feel fortunate if we even think of the people in Kosovo right now. We might actually compare and think how fortunate I am that that's not my life right now. And the Buddhist idea would be definitely think this way, because it's not an accident that I'm not having some terrible suffering right now. It's the fact that I've created the causes to have a life that's full of leisure and space and time and sanity and kindness. And therefore, the more one appreciates this, the more one can appreciate. And the more one can appreciate, actually, the causes of this. This is the idea of karma. That we've created the cause to be who we are. And if what we are is something reasonable, and if we look and compare, even with the majority of humans, we can see the enormity of suffering. So many people, right? It just comes flooding, doesn't it? From every side. Just unceasing. So the way to contemplate this in the context of karma is how unbelievably fortunate I am. Like a miracle. It's like winning the lottery, you know. But it's the result of past morality. This is the fundamental idea, Buddhist terms. That each of us, every living being, is experiencing each moment the fruit of their own past. So it's not a sense of being punished. It's not a sense of God or Buddha punishing you. So I've been a bad person, have I? Or it's not a question of being rewarded, which is the, you know, a concept we're familiar with. There's no concept like this in Buddhism. It's a question of each action we do. The word karma means action. Each action we do in itself brings its own result. It's not a question of a person judging. It doesn't need a judge. So in Buddhist terms, anger, jealousy, pride, these unhappy emotions that as humans we all know so well, they in themselves produce suffering. Not just to the person in front of me at this moment, whom I'm angry with, but by leaving an imprint in my consciousness will produce in the future suffering experiences. This is the Buddhist idea. It's really something quite fundamental. According to Buddhism, it's like a natural law, you know. It's not some set of morals that the person has laid down. Now you must be this way because you will be punished. What Buddhism is saying is we have to get in touch with this through contemplation, through really deeply becoming familiar with our own mind. To observe, to taste the truth that anger is a neurotic energy coming from a misplaced place. It's coming from the wrong place, if you wish, that only can bring suffering to me. Forget about the harm it even does to someone else. But it's like taking poison. It can only bring future suffering. So, I mean, in a general sense, I think we can all see. We can kind of agree with this. We don't need God or Buddha to tell us this, in a sense, really. Although we might defend, you know, our right to be angry in the face of certain circumstances. But in Buddhist terms, in its nature, it can only bring suffering to me. And if I check really carefully, I have to agree. I have to say I do not want suffering. It's something so fundamental. So all Buddha's saying, right at the very beginning, to really get in touch with this one, do I want suffering? Do I want happiness? So if I want happiness, and happiness is simply a word, isn't it, that we use to refer to what we want. And suffering is a word we use to refer to what we don't want. You don't even have to know the meaning of the word, you know, but just how we label. So we know we don't want what's called suffering. We know we do want what's called happiness. So all Buddha's saying is, well, that's fine. If you do want happiness, then it's reasonable, isn't it, to check out what are the causes for it. What are the causes of happiness? And what are the causes of suffering? It's a very logical thing. If I want that result, I have to then find the method of how to get it. Well, if I want happiness, and Buddha's view is simply, well, the way to be happy, and we have that potential. It's something, in fact, this concept of so-called happiness, contentment, fulfillment, whatever words we want to use, and to whatever level, right? Buddhist terms are, Buddhism is saying that this is our natural potential, fully expressed in what's called enlightenment or Buddhahood. That's the full development of this potential. It's something kind of innate. It's something tasty and experiential. Not something religious in the sense that we tend to think of religious as something imposed or separate from us or in another life or whatever. Buddhism's talking in very kind of psychological terms, and even though the concept of reincarnation doesn't sound very psychological to us, it sounds very religious in the sense of being superstitious. Nevertheless, you know, Buddhism always speaks in these psychological terms. We're dealing with human consciousness. We're dealing with what we think and feel. And the basis of practice is right here. The heart of practice is in this. Practice is within the mind. You know? So a person who's practicing Buddhism, the bottom line of it is that they're dealing with their own mind, observing their characteristics, observing their qualities, their personality, recognizing anger, kindness, love, generosity, delusion, lying, harming, whatever you want to label the various things we do and think as humans, you know. For example, just human. And learning through experience to see the consequences of these various things, and then learning from experience eventually so that we do know it, that something called kindness is necessarily the cause of happiness within, to me, forget about someone else, and that generosity, patience, love, these qualities that we all know about are the causes of my happiness, not to mention the happiness of others. But we can see, usually when we say the word kindness, it implies already another human being, doesn't it? And it implies doing something nice to another person. So what all Buddhism is saying is that type of action is what brings happiness to oneself. That's the recipe for happiness, for oneself. That's not selfish, it's just practical to know that. Because actually we want happiness so badly. What invests our choices? What is behind our choices? The choices, every choice we make in our life, if we think about it, every choice we make, to eat this one instead of this one, to walk that direction instead of this direction, to sleep this way instead of that way, to put my leg on this side instead of that side, to marry this person instead of that person, whatever small or big choice we make, you think, what is the basis of it? It's because what we think that will bring us what we want and will not bring us what we don't want. We don't choose to eat the food that is disgusting to us. We don't choose to live with a person we loathe. You know, we don't choose to put our leg into a position that will make it even more hurt, more pain. You see, it's so fundamental, it's so obvious. So everything we're doing, saying and thinking, the wish is to do it, is to get the result we want, which is happiness. So one of the most fundamental things we have to look at is, well, are we getting what we want? Does the eating of that cake bring me what I want? Does being with that person, or whatever the choices we make, do they bring the result I so badly want, which is called happiness? So if we're being very sincere, we have to see that they don't. We much of the time get a mess instead, don't we? Or we kind of wonder why, no matter how hard we try to find happiness and to follow those causes, we don't seem to get it. Or we might get it for a while and we lose it. So all Buddhists are saying is we need to look at all this. Check it out, you know, really look carefully. And if it seems reasonable, if the methods I continually use continually bring suffering, then I'm a bit of a foolish person if I don't start checking on the methods. But all he's suggesting is that perhaps we don't check up on the methods. We keep bashing our heads against brick walls. So, you know, our feeling is, well, if I live with this person, I'll get happy. And then I don't get happy, so I'll say, I'll throw that person out, I'll get another person. So I just chose the wrong person. Isn't it? That's how we are. Well, that food gets me, you know, it makes me miserable, so I'll try this one. So we keep changing the object. And one of the most fundamental views in Buddhism is that we're actually, you know, that, and this is again central, that the actual causes of happiness happen to be not able to be physical things, people, food, houses, jobs. They cannot be the cause of happiness in the way we think they are. And that's not being, again, that's not being moralistic, because if we really look at our experiences, we have to come to these conclusions. Buddha's not saying that they're not part of the cause of happiness, but in a sense what he's saying is we're investing too much power. We're looking too much to the outside. We're not looking at all at this part, at the mind. And this is the key point. This is the key point in Buddhism. That it's the way we think. It's the way we view things. It's our own state of mind. This is the source of happiness, or indeed suffering. And again, if we really look carefully at our experiences, really analyze in a fresh way, we can see how this is true. It's just very hard, that's all, to actually live by this. Because all the energy, I mean, the Buddhist way of saying it, you know, For so long, we've invested everything in the outside world, in the objects of our senses. We're totally caught up in the objects of our senses. And it's not as if this is you're a bad person because that's what you do. All Buddha's saying is it's simply mistaken. It's just mistaken. It's a mistaken method. It doesn't work. He's saying it just doesn't work. It's not a question of being moralistic. It's not a question of saying you're a bad person. It's not a question of this at all. It's simply a practical issue that these methods don't work. But basically he's saying, all Buddha's saying is if we invest so much power in that cake, you know, that just that simple object, if we check carefully our mind, really looking deeply beyond the instinctive natural responses we seem to have that we never look into, we will begin to see that we put huge power, the particular state of mind in this case called attachment, invests so much more in cake than it's possibly capable of giving. This is the point. In other words, we exaggerate grotesquely the power of cake to make us happy. And if we really, really looked at this, really went into it, we would agree that this is so. But why it's so hard to see this, although this is happening 1,000 times, you know, dozens of times a day in our lives, we don't seem to get this lesson from it. We keep trying the object. And then we're always, you know, and we never even check. We have to see that mostly what we end up with after we've eaten cake, you know, is a full stomach. And still, the dissatisfaction. It's rare to really find that happiness, to really find that satisfaction, which is exactly why we'll be eating the third piece when the stomach has been shouting since the first that it's full, please. It's kind of that point alone is something very interesting to contemplate. So what isn't satisfied? We're not stupid. We know our stomach is full. So why do we keep eating? Because we haven't found the happiness yet, that's why. We keep searching. We keep eating, thinking, hopefully, you know, that another piece just might do it. It's a simple way of saying. And so in Buddhist terms, this particular state of mind is the one called attachment. One of its functions is that it exaggerates. It exaggerates the power, the quality, the good quality, the power of a certain object to give me happiness. So it can be a person, an object. It can be something like, you know, reputation, job, whatever, you know, these types of things. The energy of attachment, this mind of attachment, is very insidious, very spontaneous. And it's actually, in Buddhist terms, an interesting way to say, it's a mistaken state of mind. Mistaken in the simple sense that what it perceives, cake is incredibly delicious and if I have it I'll get happy, is in fact not accurate. This is a very interesting way that Buddhism would look at these seeming, what we call emotions, you know. We don't even think of an emotion, do we, as a way of seeing. But this is the Buddhist approach. So the way of, you know, the emotion of anger, as one Lama said, is simply the response that comes when attachment doesn't get what it wants. So if you're hungry for chocolate cake, building up that energy, expecting all the expectations, waiting for the chocolate cake, really hungry for it, you know, attached, strong attachment energy, wanting it excitedly to come, and then carrot cake comes instead, you know, we can see. You mightn't get strong anger, but this other type of mind, the opposite of attachment, aversion, revolting. So the more strongly you want chocolate cake, the more horrible carrot cake looks, isn't it? So we can see that this is, you know, we have these states of mind. They're normal, everyday states of mind that we have, and we assume they are normal, they are part of the human being, and they are normal. Part of the human being. Well, what the Buddha's view is, though, they're not that, you know, okay, the Western view, our view seems to be, isn't it? This is just who we are. I'm a human. I've got a mixture of so-called good qualities and so-called negative ones. And if, you know, as long as the negative ones aren't too extreme, as long as my anger doesn't express itself in killing somebody or being so horrible every day that it just turns everyone away, then I'm a normal human being. As long as I can keep it under control, not too much attachment, not too much anger, not too much jealousy, not too much pride, then I'm a reasonable human being. Well, what Buddhism is saying, that sure, it is human. This is part of the deal of being a human. But that actually, we have the potential to be absolutely free of these so-called negative qualities as humans. And as a human, uniquely, we have the capacity, because of our intelligence, because of the capacity to think and to make choices, we have, as a human, this extraordinary potential to actually radically change our mind, to radically transform who we are. This is exactly what Buddhism is saying. This is practice. Because ultimately this thing called enlightenment is just a word that refers to the state of being of a person who has done the job of uprooting completely these so-called negative states of mind. It's exactly all it means. Okay, it happens to be an astonishing state of being. We wouldn't even conceive of it. We don't conceive of it as possible. As I'm saying, you know, most of us, we think, as long as I'm not too attached, too angry, too jealous, then I'm a reasonable human being. Well, Buddhism's saying we're basically shortchanging ourselves, you know. We have, in fact, the potential to be absolutely free of this stuff. Now, this is exactly the practice. This is practice. This is the job to be done. Achieving enlightenment, sounding, you know, this mysterious thing, is simply the job of continually lessening the deluded states of mind and continually growing the positive, and that it's an organic, natural kind of process, you know, not just some kind of random thing. Just like you would grow anything. If you continue to practice piano, you will continue to become a better musician, won't you? It's logical. If you continue to nourish the seeds in your ground, your the trees will continue to grow. It's not random at all. So if you continue to grow love and kindness and patience and generosity, and if you continue to pull out the weeds of anger and hate and jealousy and pride, random result, it's a very clear, obvious and logical result. You become an astonishing person. This is exactly what Buddhism is saying. And as a human, we have this character, we have this ability. We mightn't all have the conditions. If you're a Kosovar right now, somehow, you know, the intensity of the suffering and the fear. If you're a Serb right now, very hard, you know, got the human mind, but this intensity of anger and rage, I mean, forget about it. I mean, just even ourselves, you know, when the wrong cake comes, look how disturbed the mind gets, you know. We're fully grown adults. Look at us. It's like we're children, isn't it, with no control at all, isn't it? We can see in our lives one person whom we might meet. It shocks us, the intensity of our responses, right? Attachment, anger, whatever. It surprises us. So in a way, it sounds so easy. I mean, it's words that we can easily say. Lessen anger, lessen attachment, grow love, grow kindness. Such simple words. But the job, the hardest job on earth, you know. And the reason, in Buddhist terms, actually, is simply because this consciousness, which I said before, it just didn't begin at the time of conception of this birth and won't, you know, is a continuity. And that we create it from our own past actions, imprinted on that consciousness, basically programmed it to go into the new womb of the new mother. And so this new person, at the moment of conception, all the qualities of this person here now, in kind of, you know, miniature, waiting to be ripened. You know, Hitler wasn't just some creation of only other people. He wasn't just a creation of circumstances. He was Hitler from the day he was conceived. He brought all that energy with him, you know. He had created the cause from countless other lives, countless other actions of power and harming, the wish to harm, to then manifest as this little Austrian guy, you know. In that mother, in the new womb of that new mother. Boom. And all the conditions known as Nazi Germany, blah, 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 were the conditions in which he then grew that potential that he had planted the seeds for a long time ago. This is the Buddhist explanation. So even though he was a human, the potential was there, you know, but the potential for positive was there, but it wasn't exercised. The other energy was so strong. So I don't know, I could talk about many things, but maybe people have some questions and go in a different direction. Yeah.
So when we come to the point where we realize that the status, children, sensory pleasures aren't going to fill us, what are the step-by-step things that we can do
I understand exactly. It's really interesting, but it's almost as if your first huge, major step is that simple recognition. In other words, one of the things that Buddhism is saying, one way of saying what Buddha is saying, is that almost everything is view. It's how we see things, how we perceive. So what he's saying is, as soon as you start to see the cake isn't what you thought it was, already contentment comes. Just that step alone. It's not as if, no, now I no longer see that cake causes me happiness. Now what? But it's in there already. It's inherent. The finding of contentment is inherent in the recognition that cake isn't the cause of it. Already, it's the first. So it comes at the same time. Do you see? Practice. Doing it again and again. Just simply doing it again and again and again and again and again and again. Just like anything. In this sense, and I think it's important for us in our culture to really demystify so-called spiritual practice. We get so airy-fairy about it. And we're so mysterious. So we understand very easily the logic of becoming a pianist, becoming a carpenter. You learn methods. You get a goal. You label it. You get the methods. And then you do them. And you do them. And you do them. And you do them. Right? Until eventually you become a pianist. This is exactly the same. There's no mystery in that sense.
So then, what are the practical things that you do for that?
Well, this is what Buddhist practice is, if you like. I mean, the whole deal of practice is, you know, the Buddhist way of saying it would be, and again, I have to use an ordinary example of if you want to become a carpenter. So you first establish, I want to become a carpenter. So what's the first thing you do? You listen to the teachings. You listen to the theories of carpentry. You listen to the principles, the concepts. Then what do? You think about them to see how they all work and how does it make sense. You put it all together. And then you start putting your hands on and doing it. So it's the same here. This is more difficult. It's more subtle in the sense that every part of it, the listening, the thinking and the doing, is all in the mind. Whereas as the carpenter, it's fairly easy to distinguish between the theory and the practice, isn't it? Because in the practice, you're using your hands. So you don't get confused. But we often can, it's very difficult for us to see that the intellectual part of our mind is the first part of listening and thinking. Then the actual experiencing of it is what the practice is. And so in relation to the simple example of the cake, I don't know, I mean, we have, this is not something mystical. We do this all the time, you know. Let's say, you know, I just smoke cigarettes. So what I was trying to do was stop smoking cigarettes. So how did I do that? My mind, my hand didn't stop smoking cigarettes, did it? Finally, my hand stopped going out. But why? All the work had been done in my mind. I had made the decision. I didn't want to smoke cigarettes. So what I had to do, in a way, was contemplate the disadvantages of smoking. Beforehand, as a smoker, in other words, what I'd been doing was contemplating the advantages of smoking, because that's why I smoked. So what I'm trying to get at is here, much of what practice is at the initial stages, one aspect of practice, is using the thinking mind to reassess. So the usual view of attachment is, and it's instinctive to us, it feels pretty instinctive, and in Buddhist terms, it's instinctive only because we've done it often enough that it no longer feels like a thinking process. Right, it's just we've done it often enough, it's just now automatic for us. So what we have to do is reverse that automatic process. And in the beginning that's painful, to go against any old automatic habit. So the first stage is I have to start, you know, listening to, let's say, Buddha's view. Oh, I see, well, cake isn't the cause of my happiness. You know, initially there's a lot of shock about that because everything seems to argue with that. You know, the stomach is empty, I put the cake in, my stomach gets full, I enjoy the cake, there's a flavour, there's a kind of excitement. That seems to be what is actually happiness. So how is it true that cake isn't the cause of happiness? Even that is quite subtle to get that, you know, because it doesn't seem to be true. So it's the whole process. We have that door open for some reason? Huh? It just seems to be, I don't know. Maybe it doesn't make much difference. Anyway. Okay, I'm saying anything. I'm trying to say. Go on. Another way of saying. The way Buddhist psychology, the way Buddhism talks about the mind, and we've got these different characteristics in the mind, which is obvious. And they use it, actually, we can say states of mind. So there's one called, yes, discrimination. There's one called mindfulness. There's many of these qualities. So they're like these different muscles that you need to develop to do this job. So the first one, listening even to this concept that cake doesn't make you happy, that grasping at that outside object won't bring you what you think it will, which is contentment and fulfillment. So you have to even have enough awareness to even listen to that and even get something about it that's true. Because if you hear those words and they sound like a load of rubbish, you won't even bother going further. So already you've got some kind of mind that is able to even hear that. And then the ability to discriminate, the ability to think about it, to apply some kind of intelligence, to analyse how that is not so, how that's true. So, interestingly, in Tibetan Buddhism, we use a term for a certain kind of meditation called, we say analytical. So this process that's happening in our minds, each of us in our own way right at this moment, is in a sense accurately called meditation. And the meaning of it in meditation, the broadest sense, is actually familiarizing your mind with a certain way of seeing things. Familiarizing your mind. It's the meaning of the Tibetan word, meditation. There are other kinds of meditation where you're training your mind to be focused, you use your mind to do visualization. There's different ways you use your mind, but a major way, certainly the Tibetan Buddhist approach, is to use it in an intelligent way, to analyze, to think. Because all Buddha is saying is, for eons, we've had these mistaken conceptions in our mind about reality. And we are now absolutely sucked into them, which is why it feels like instinct. But instinct is simply, as I said, in the Buddhist way, is simply having done something for so long, it becomes automatic. We can see how this happens. So what we're trying to do is, conditioning, that's all. Conditioning for a long time, not just this life. And so conditioned that we don't even question any longer. So what we have to do is just start to reverse that process and learn to actually bring analysis, internal analysis, to everything we think, everything we say, everything we do, how we perceive reality, how we perceive people. What do I mean by he is unkind? What do I mean by she is good? Truly analysis. As one Lama said, actually practice, and it's not meant to be some cliche, is really learning to be your own therapist in a very profound way, Not sort of circling around getting more crazy, but using analysis and logic in a very intelligent way in order to come to a conclusion, in order to bring a new conclusion. This is exactly a very major, major part of practice. This is really a way of saying what practice is. And then there are different kinds of meditation techniques that you use to really train the ability of the mind to be very focused and concentrated. And in the longer term, you gain the ability to actually access subtler levels of consciousness, which right now in our ordinary human Western world, we don't even recognize as even existing. But in Buddhist terms, we have much subtler levels of awareness, conscious awareness, that have an enormous amount of power. And that are capable of getting realizations very deeply, very quickly about the nature of reality. But we start where we are, which is at this gross conceptual level. And already at this level, we can do a phenomenal amount of transformation. So it's learning to... So, we're not trying to change anything in an absolute sense, because it's up to us what views we use. I can decide I'm a communist, so I'm going to have to go listen to Marx and Lenin and listen to their views of reality. And then slowly, you change your view, and then that becomes the way you interpret what you see. Everything is how you interpret it. There's no absolute out there. Everything is how you interpret it. We can call it in this sense. If I'm a Christian, I interpret something this way. If I'm a Buddhist, I interpret it this way. If I'm a communist, I interpret it this way. If I've got a mishmash of all of them in my mind, I might have my own interpretation. I'm a Rabbinist, But we all have a view. And what Buddha is saying is, the view we have is what causes us to be happy or suffering. So if I'm a communist, and I at one point in my life that was my view, so every time I saw rich people, I got angry. Every time I saw poor people, I felt compassion, That was my view. Then I was a feminist. Every time I saw a male person, I got angry. Do you understand? So everything is view. And it's astonishing. I might think, I'm not a communist, a feminist, a Buddhist, or this, but as I said, I'm a Rabbinist. I've got a series of views in my mind that are investing everything I say, So what Buddha is saying is, listen, honey, check up. See if your view is in sync with how something is. Because what he is suggesting is that it's not. And he's saying, and that's what he calls samsara. So we're all samsarists. So being a samsarist means having this completely, upside down, insane view that cakes bring happiness and ugly people bring you suffering and this. And he's saying you're all wrong. You're just completely wrong, is all he's saying. Not bad, just wrong. So what he's suggesting is, what Buddhism is, if you like, and he's not trying to shove it down our throat. He's saying that what he has discovered is the view of reality. It's up, and Christians say the same. Everybody says the same, and that's why he says you've got to check up. So he's suggesting the way that we now label what is Buddhism is simply the way is a description of reality at whatever level. gross and then very subtle levels. So what a Buddhist is a person who's given that some thought, who thinks, well, there's something reasonable in that, and then who's slowly learning to make that their own view. And then Buddha says, finally, you'll discover from your own experience. The bottom line is you will discover from your own experience. And as the Dalai Lama says, Buddhism has nothing to defend. If you can discover genuinely from your own experience something that Buddha said is actually mistaken, you must give it up. You must throw it out. It's not a question of being right because Buddha said. It's a question of being right if it is right. In other words, if this is black, it doesn't matter who calls it what. If it is black, then it is black. That is truth. So it's a question of discovering truth. You know, this is exactly the way Buddhism is saying. You know? And that's for each of us to find the way we find. You know? So yeah, awareness, discrimination, mindfulness, intelligence, all these qualities. Yeah, I mean, makes sense? Yeah. So really the view, the way, the approach in Buddhism is this one, very, very much this one. I mean, Buddhist philosophy is quite extensive, you know, quite vast, quite deep. All the views in Buddhism are quite extensive. But the key thing is, it's like he's saying, don't believe a single word I'm telling you, you know. This is what I have found to be truth. So then it's up to you now. You listen to it, you think about it, use it as a method, and then you will discover your own, from your own experience, whether it's true or not. And what the point is in Buddhism is that it's not a question of simply knowing what's true and kind of like, oh, well, now what? The interesting point that Buddha is saying is that it is our lack of knowledge of truth that is why we suffer. And that when we discover truth, we actually also will discover happiness. But this is what, these somehow go together, you know. So it sounds like saying seeing things the way they are, kind of what's that got to do with being happy, we think. Well, that's Buddha's point. It's because we don't see things the way they are is why we suffer so much. In other words, a simple view in Buddhism, one of the tenets of Buddhism, is that phenomena are impermanent. Now, this is something intellectually, fairly easily, we can concur with. You know, it's not a problem for our minds. But what Buddha's saying is this. So there's something subtler anyway. The experience of it is something quite subtle. So it's like Buddha says glasses, they're impermanent. They're compounded phenomena. They're made up, they come from cause and conditions. They're constantly changing. They'll eventually disintegrate, you know. They're impermanent, they're changing. Now what he's saying is this. We think that when my glasses break, that's why I suffer. When the person leaves me, when the body gets wrinkled and old, when my beautiful cup breaks, when the money gets stolen, we think that's why I suffer. No, all he's saying is no. Because he's saying why I suffer is because I have a misconception deep in my heart that glasses shouldn't break, that a person shouldn't leave me. So it's not as if it's being kind of all nihilistic and thinking, oh, well, people are going to leave me and things break, how depressing, that's just life, that's why not expect it. Not like that. It's simply something realistic. So given within the context of impermanence, one enjoys life. But as long as you have the view that it shouldn't break, then you are demanding suffering. You're setting yourself up for suffering. The way Buddha is saying, we are constantly setting ourselves up for suffering by having a misconception that, you know, that cakes will bring happiness, that a person will bring happiness, therefore the person shouldn't leave me, therefore thou shouldn't die. So all this build-up of fantasy stories our mind makes. And it's the extent to which we cling to those stories is the extent to which we are shattered when we discover they're not true. We keep thinking something is, you know, we keep thinking it's the glasses breaking that's the fault. So what do? We try to invent glasses that don't break, you know, because we're just not getting the right message. So within the context of impermanence, for example, impermanence is one of the grosser levels of Buddha's view of reality, you know. We think we're miserable because it was the wrong cake, so we try to make a better chocolate cake next time. No, what Buddha's saying is it's because you're setting yourself up for suffering because it's not the job of a cake to bring you happiness. It's the job of a cake to fill your stomach, yeah. It's the job of a cake, if you like, to be a catalyst to activate some pleasure. And this is why, certainly, when you study Buddhist psychology, you know, Buddha has a very kind of detailed model of the mind, the nature of mind, how it functions, what it is, what it's this, how it isn't physical. These things are all kind of not just intellectual concepts. They're actually very, you know, have tasty experiential applications, implications. About the mind, for example, that, you know, one of the logical reasons why cake can't bring you happiness, which doesn't impact much on us when we hear it first, it's a state of being, it's a state of mind. We know this. One morning, you can wake up and you can just feel happy, right? I mean, we might, occasionally. Just feel good. We haven't had the cake yet. Nothing's happened even. No one's even said any good words to us. And we just kind of feel kind of light, you know. And we are, other mornings, we can just wake up and feel absolutely disaster. And no matter what happens, no matter how many cakes you have, everything's a disaster. We know this again and again. If you're miserable, then even the nice things have no impact on you. Even when you're very happy, even miserable things can't hurt you. We know this. These are the points to really see that mind, you know, doesn't have to be affected. Consciousness doesn't have to be affected by external phenomena. It has, you know, it's. And so one of the key things here is simply that consciousness, happiness, joy, love, these things are non-physical parts of us. They have a very, you know, there's a very intimate relationship between the brain and the nervous system. It's fairly obvious. And one of the points that is gone into in great depth in Buddhist psychology is that consciousness is not physical. It's not the brain. Yes, indeed, there's this intimate relationship between this body, this brain, and how I think and feel. It's really clear. But in Buddhist terms, finally, you know, happiness, love, joy, kindness, anger, jealousy, contentment, they are not physical qualities. And my feeling is a logical reason to prove this, although it sounds so simplistic, is that if it were, excuse me, all the lobotomies we've done would have worked perfectly. And we tried it at some point, isn't it, in this culture, to cut out the bits of the brain. We just created a mess, you know. I mean, if anger were simply something physical, why isn't it we haven't found it already? Why, after we're such clever scientists for this, you know, centuries we've been doing all this kind of work, I'm sorry, why is it not so easy just to simply go, there is anger, just like a cancer, and pull it out? Excuse me. I'm sorry, it is logical, I think, what I'm saying. You know? But we just get more and more confused the more we think it's physical, yet we can't find it. If we could find it and pull it out, we'd all be perfect by now. You know? So happiness is a state of mind. And we can see the people again and again and again, you know. Endless. I mean, so often, so common to see this. People with enormous suffering just have happy minds, you know. I remember vividly one day I went to see two people who were dying. And one, excruciating pain, been suffering, paralyzed from pain, you know, for 10 years. I looked into this woman's eyes and her mind was happy. She was smiling. Another woman, fear, just horror in her eyes, you know. They both had enormous physical pain. It's clear, the mind, you know, it can be something that is not a victim of the physical, of the external. We can see this in our own lives again and again, but we don't believe it enough to really train in it. And this is the key thing in Buddhist practice. It's training in this principle to profound degrees. Not to dismiss the outside world, but to become, you know, our own, to become empowered, to empower ourselves. Right now, what you can say is, overpowering attachment to that delicious chocolate cake is like this tiny child that puts all the power on the outside and is essentially saying, I'm nothing. Well, I'm dependent for who I am. My happiness is dependent on, you know, a bunch of chocolate cake. Whereas all Buddhism is saying is, actually, we have the power to be phenomenal beings. You know, by concentrating more on the mind itself, consciousness itself, the emotions themselves, and giving less power to the cake, the other person. Not becoming detached in a negative way at all. On the contrary. Person who's given up attachment, and attachment isn't liking something. Attachment is a neurotic, dependent state of mind that gives the power to the cake, to the person, and it becomes like a child and is devastated. Feels like nothing unless someone says, I love you. This is attachment. It's like the mind of a child, a very disturbed child. So a person who's given up attachment actually enjoys the cake more. That's the irony. We all know when you're so grasping, just simply over a piece of cake, so grasping, when it comes, you miss the pleasure completely. You're shoving it in. By the third piece, you've lost anything. You can't remember anything. You know, you just now got a stuffed stomach. There's no pleasure at all. We all know this, you know. When we give too much power to the outside, to a person, I mean, we can see the suffering we have with enormous attachment, enormous grasping after another person. And what grasping is, another way of saying it in Buddhist terms, you know, is that it's the state of mind of a very unhappy, neurotic kind of pinhead size me. But saying that person is everything, and when they say I love you, then I must be something. That's really what attachment's doing. And when they say I hate you, then I am nothing. That's why we become so shattered. That's why we are devastated when someone leaves us. Because we've invested our sense of who we are in someone else. This is the suffering of attachment. It's suffering, you know. That's the suffering of attachment. So we can, you know, if we can, so the other qualities are called love, you know. Loving someone is a delight in their happiness, is a recognition of the other person, is altruism, is sort of a sense of another person existing as a real being, you know, separate from me. And we can delight in who they are. We can delight in their joy. That's called love. And that's the cause of happiness. Attachment, which is a huge sense of a neurotic me, but it's like miniature me, frantically putting this person up on a pedestal, believing that when they love me, then I'm something. That's, I mean, it's the state of mind of a mad person. But we all know it. It's familiar to us. And it's deeply inside us, isn't it? We didn't have to, you know, our mother didn't have to teach us this. So because we've kind of also, because we have never discriminated between the so-called negative states of mind, these suffering ones, and the so-called positive ones, we tend to think they all just come in a big package, like milk and water mixed together. We've never discriminated between attachment and love. We don't even know how to. And why we don't know how to is not because it's so mysterious in its nature. It's only mysterious to us because we've never learned how to look here. We're always looking out there, you know. So again, the approach in Buddhism is through the techniques called meditation. We're learning a brand new skill. We're learning to look inside. And we're learning to look inside and to invest that looking with some kind of intelligence, some view that is able to label accurately the different parts of us, to discriminate between attachment and love in the relationship to that person. So in other words, and sometimes you can just get a tasty way of how this works, you know. Attachment, for example, if you check if there's strong attachment, let's say I have to Roy. That's like this frantic neediness inside me that is disturbed when he's not there, that's panicking when he is there, just desperate that he might leave me. All the manipulation that goes on as a result of that attachment. You know, the mind is very disturbed. And in a sense, you can see when it's a deluded state of mind, in the Buddhist way of saying, there's a strong sense of him here and me there. So when it's anger, it's ugly him. When it's attachment, it's delicious him. And you've got to shut him in and get him, you know. Fill yourself up with him. But when it's love, for example, a positive quality, it's more a sense of it's comfortable, it's not neurotic, it doesn't feel disturbed, it feels very good, and there's a sense of a we, isn't there? Isn't there? You know, I can just be chatting away, and suddenly we start to argue. So when we're just chatting away, being all friendly, it kind of feels close, doesn't it? There's like a we. And suddenly, he says things I don't like, I say things he doesn't like, we're kind of literally putting this big bridge between us, this barrier between us. And now it's me and him, separate. Well, they are like simple ways of seeing. We can recognize in our own mind when it feels separate from someone. That's the indication of the presence of delusion, of neurosis in my own mind. Attachment, anger, jealousy, confusion, fear, ignorance, you know, whatever the labels are. They happen to be the source of my suffering. Not him, not his words. Which is what we think now. Absolutely, don't we? And that when I'm happy, when there's some pleasure in my mind, some joy, he indeed can be the catalyst for it. But the real, the main cause of it is my capacity for happiness in my own mind. In other words, right now I think he causes me suffering when he gets angry. As if his angry words sort of injected suffering into Robina. Not at all. Robina's suffering comes from Robina's disturbed mind when he says mean words. So one of the things, the discrimination we need to develop, which is so difficult because we're like glued to each other right now, One of the key kind of the things to really develop is the capacity to distinguish between my feelings and his actions. My feelings and his actions. And then to recognize that it's my feelings, my thoughts, my view, my interpretation, my anger, my kindness, my love, that are the source, the main source of my state of mind, not his actions. They're merely the catalyst. Whereas right now, it's completely the opposite, isn't it? Everything is on the outside. We are such victims of the outside. The slightest change in the weather, we're thrown completely, you know. The slightest change in Roy's face, I'm panic-stricken, isn't it? We're constantly, like, searching for all the outside to be just, you know, to get it all nice, to give us the right feedback, to keep reassuring us that I'm a reasonable human being. It's like insane, you know. So what Buddha's saying is this is the source of enormous suffering. So to do this job just takes time, that's all. Just takes a lot of analysis, a lot of clarity, a lot of will, a lot of determination, a lot of being so mindful. I mean, mindfulness in this job is the hugest one. It's the ability to catch your own thoughts and feelings as they're happening and to observe those more than his words. Whereas right now, we're magnetized, aren't we, by the outside world. Everything we just go sucking out to the outside world. That's what we see. That's what we describe. So someone says, Rabina, what's wrong? Roy did this, and he said that, and he said this, and the weather this, and the face this, and the cake that. Always we describe the outside. We don't describe what's happening inside here at all. We don't even know how to describe what's happening inside us. We know we feel miserable, but we're so absolutely convinced that he is the source of it. But that's what we describe. And that's what we therefore expect to change. So when he changes, the logic goes, I'll be better. Which is why we try to manipulate the outside world. Which is just you have to look at the Western world to see. It's the result of attachment. It's obvious that the Western world believes the outside world is the cause of happiness. That's why we spend so much time on it. It's obvious Tibetans didn't. They lived in a medieval, backward world, you know, with yogis in mountains doing amazing, extraordinary things. It's clear. They didn't put too much in the outside world. Not because they're stupid. It's because they didn't give it any power, you know. It's obvious what we think is most powerful. Just look at the world. You know? It's a product of our own minds. This world is a creation of human beings. It just didn't. Buildings and things and machines and clever things didn't pop up from their own side, did they? They're the product of human mind. And what we produce comes from our view. So it doesn't mean we have to give up chocolate cake. Not at all. Just see it more accurately. That's all. See it for what it is. See it more accurately. Give it appropriate place in your life. Its job is to fill your stomach and give you, you know, touch the tongue and bring some kind of nice, you know, activate some pleasure in the mind. Fantastic. Why not? But it certainly can't bring happiness. No way. It's not its job at all, you know. But this is, I mean, it's easy words, but my goodness, truly the hardest job. And it's hard only, not in its nature hard, it's hard simply because we are addicted to the opposite. That's all. That's all. That's why it's necessary, the Buddhist approach is necessary to think about it so carefully, to think about it, to see if there's some kind of logic to it, to see if it sounds reasonable. Not just leap in, you know, with blind faith, nor reject it with, you know, blind opposite of faith. But to think about it, to see if it's something reasonable. And then slowly, slowly, with humility and patience, to practice. And then to slowly get the results oneself. And that's how we get confidence, by seeing the results, you know. Because finally it's experiential, not just some theory. But the irony, the sad irony is, especially in our culture, because we are so addicted to objects and phenomena and believing that things cause happiness, the second we try a new method then it doesn't bring happiness immediately, we'll assume it doesn't work, so we'll give up, you know. We'll give up immediately. And this is part of the problem. So we need a long-term view. So I don't know, what else do people have to say? Anyone got some questions? Still? Something to say maybe? Thank you so much. Yellow. I think this historically, I think it came historically. Oh, look at this. Thank you very much. My chocolate cake. Thank you, Roy. I think historically, because the Hindu culture at the time was the culture in which Buddhism grew, and all the sadhus, these people who gave up the ordinary life and became these wandering practitioners, they wore yellow robes. So I think simply Buddha, that's just the cultural reason. But of course, since then, you know, it's given some meaning. I've heard in the Tibetan tradition that it refers to, I think it's because, I don't know, I hear different interpretations of the meaning of different colors. But I think that's the simple cultural reason. That was what the sadhus wore. So then Buddhist monks wore the same type of thing. It's kind of the clothing of a person who'd given up the life, ordinary life, you know, the householder's life, as they call it. But I think, you know, in different countries these robes have developed different. So this is a Tibetan style. I mean, you wear the yellow one on top for certain reasons. And I think really it's because this dye was what was available. I mean, it's just whereas in, you know, China and Japan they wear grey and black, you know, quite different with long sleeves, because culturally it's not appropriate to have a bare arm. So they always cover their arms. But, you know, so this is the Indian style. This has come out of the culture of India, having this showing. So they developed that in Tibet as well. Just for monks and nuns, everybody else they don't. So I think there's a cultural basis in much of it, you know. But it's invested with some kind of meaning after that, you know. Something else, people? No? Nothing? No. All right. Oh, I mean, well, I've been a nun for 21 years, so doing my best for 21 years. A little bit less angry, a little bit more kind, maybe, hope so. After 21 years of nothing changed, I'd be pretty stupid to keep being a Buddhist, wouldn't I? So something has to have changed a little bit. Yes? That's interesting. I quit. The first time, usually because I'm a bit of an extremist in my nature, the first time I did, I usually do it immediately, boom, like that. And I know I quit for a year and then I smoked again. But I think the first time I was smoking 80 cigarettes a day, really extreme. I mean, really extreme. Marlboros and things, I remember. So I really just gave it up. And then for a year, when I was a hippie, I started smoking and I was rolling my own and smoking a lot of marijuana as well, you know. So then I gave it up the second time. And then again, just gave it up like that. Just made the decision. And I think, and that's something interesting, I think the second time I gave it up, I wasn't a Buddhist at the time, I was a Buddhist, but I really remember, and this is the point for me, it's very meaningful as a Buddhist now, what I really remember wanting to give up wasn't so much the cigarette, was this incredibly suffering habit, being like a victim to an object. This was, I really knew that was the suffering. Do you see what I mean? I mean, I could see it was hurting my body. But the real one I was relieved to give up was being bound by this thing, thinking about it day and night. That's what made me crazy. And that's the key thing in Buddhism. That, of course, some objects are killers, you know. Cigarettes, alcohol can really damage us. But but the real suffering is the addiction, is the need for the object, and the having to think about it all the time, manipulate to get it and be miserable when you haven't got it. That's the suffering. And that's the suffering of attachment. Do you see? So attachment isn't referring necessarily to an object. It's just referring to that awful neediness, that just being a prisoner. That's the real suffering. Well, I think, and I could remember, even when I wasn't a Buddhist, I remember vividly that's what I was relieved to give up, to the point where I simply didn't have to think about that object anymore. It was like a huge, it was like freedom. Makes sense, doesn't it? That's the difficulty, I think. And that's the thing that all Buddha's saying, I think, that if we can really look not just at gross objects like maybe chocolate cake and maybe cigarettes, or maybe some people, but to really see how this one of attachment, it sort of sounds brutal sometimes, really pervades everything we do. We have attachment to what people think we are. We have attachment to just endless. We're just constantly needy of so many things and so many people and so many situations. And if we can really see that enormous neediness is what causes us to be disturbed so easily the moment it's not met. Do you understand? And that's the real suffering. So it's not as if when you give up attachment you become some kind of an indifferent person who doesn't care about things. It's actually not like that at all. It's sort of really finding the freedom of not being a victim. Do you understand? Not being bound by all these needs, you know. Then you enjoy cake more, you enjoy your relationships more, you enjoy your job more. You know, someone is mean to you, it doesn't hurt you so much. It just means like we grow up almost by giving up attachment, you know. Does it make sense what I'm saying? It's just that it's hard, that's all. This is really the very essence of Buddhist practice, this one. This is the very essence of it, you know. And so in that sense too, it's not something to do with religious in the way we think of religious, it's believing in something. It's truly experiential. And all Buddha's saying is actually, and we have to find that out too, is that it is our potential. By really learning to know our own minds. You can be a rich millionaire, you can have, you know, boyfriends by the dozen, you can eat chocolate cake as much as you like. When you really have discovered your own mind is a source of happiness, then everything you do is like a game, it's a play, you enjoy it. It's not like suffering, you know. But you can enjoy cake, enjoy sex, enjoy things. But when it's usually coming from attachment, it's like just torture and suffering and pain and fear and misery. I mean, we know this, you know. Don't you think? It's hard, exactly. But it's so interesting, as one lama said, when we hear, you know, Buddha's kind of saying, sorry guys, you want to be happy, you've got to give up attachment. So it's sort of like immediately we feel, you mean I've got to give up my heart? It feels like that. Because we think that when we even say the word attachment, we refer it to people and things that we think give us pleasure. And it's not as if it's not a total lie. There is some truth there. But all Buddhism is saying is we're exaggerating it. We're distorting it. We're not really seeing it we're not being precise enough. It's an interesting way to say it, you know. And that just needs looking, that's all. It just needs a lot of looking at to really discover how that's so. And what's interesting too, in our ordinary culture, you know, we can decide we're going to give up chocolate cake and get thin. We just put the attachment on another object. So that isn't the problem. It's not as if cake is the real problem in the end. And I can see with cigarettes, I might have given up cigarettes, but the attachment energy within me was just the same. You just dump it on something else. So the real key here is to give up the energy itself, so you stop dumping it on objects altogether. That's the one. And I remember seeing on the television recently a show about people. It was about addictions, and it was talking mainly about, I think, gambling. The terrible suffering of the addiction of gambling, these slot machines especially, and for women mostly apparently. Very interesting. And as one woman, I mean, she was just in tears because she just talked of her whole life, having this addiction energy, as she, you know, referring to it. So one time it was food, then it was alcohol, then it was drugs, and now it's gambling. So we keep as long as you keep changing the object and not going deep enough and looking at this, you just keep finding another object, and the suffering continues. The suffering continues, you know. That's the thing. So giving up the object when it's a very severe one is the first step, but it's only the first step. Then you've got to do the work of shifting the actual state of mind, you know, which is the hardest one of all. So, yeah. Yes, good. You mean where I'm living now?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. There are quite a few places around Tibetan Buddhist, other ones as well. The one I'm living at is in Soquel, just out of Santa Cruz. And at the moment there's a retreat there, about 100 people going on. But there are always courses and things there, and it's a wonderful place to come to. It's about 100 acres of trees, and people can come and walk and look, and there are classes and things there. For sure, it's open. Yes, it is, in fact. Absolutely. No, I think, well, certainly in the magazine, take one of those magazines, it's in the middle there. In the middle section, there's the one in Soquel, it's called Land of Medicine Buddha. There are several in the around, many around. But there, for sure, it's open, absolutely. That's its kind of job, you know. Yeah. No, it could be different. I mean, they're made of, you can have your beads made of anything, you know. Is that what you mean? You can have. Oh, I see. Sometimes traditionally you would have bone for certain practices and wood for others, but it's not really like that in the West. We just use anything you like, you know, for sure. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, go on, honey. I know, yes. No, exactly. But your husband and your children. I mean, it almost seems like impossible to be able to distinguish. This is the thing. So, you know, the Buddhist way of saying, you know, let's say, assume you're attached to your husband here, right? Just assume you're talking about him or your kids or whatever. But it's like a package. You've got a bit of attachment, you've got some love, compassion, this, a bit of jealousy, a bit of anger, the whole soup, isn't there? This is what makes us up as humans. Now, of course, depending on if it's 70% attachment and 20% love, then that's when you have the terrible relationships. That's when you have the fights and the dramas and the jealousy and the murders and the killings and the leavings and all that. That's when it's mostly attachment. As long as you get what you want from him, as long as he's giving you pleasure and does what you want when you want it, then you'll continue to be around him. But honey, as soon as he starts doesn't bring what you want and your 70% attachment is not getting what it wants, fury. Chuck him out, you know. It's almost like it's even more. It becomes to the animal mind almost. Just, you know, when you get hungry, you're going to eat your babies. I mean, mummy lions, when she's really hungry, she has to eat a baby, right? So that's when it's really big attachment. When it's just huge, I need. But let's say it's only 30% attachment. Then love and the others can temper that. You understand? So to the extent that there's that amount of attachment, is there that amount of suffering. So the job is all the time looking, recognizing, okay, the Buddhist view is you've got a strong karmic connection from past lives, as Buddhism would say, with a certain person. So you meet them again in this life, it's like magnet, pow, oh, there he is again, hi. And it's like the old friend you just met again. It's a very common feeling, isn't it? Really old feeling. You meet this person again, you kind of keep on bopping with them. Oh, off we go again, you know. That's very real for Buddhist view. But then depending on whether you deal with it at the attachment level or whether you bring it up more to the love and the kindness and the patience. So we can all see in the beginning of a relationship, enormous energy, enormous sexual energy, enormous attachment and bliss and wow and far out. But then, you know, they become an ordinary human being after a while. You settle down into the hard grind of making a relationship out of this. And the level to which it continues is the capacity to lessen the attachment and increase the kindness and patience and love. And it's like that's the job. It's like a constant, you know, balancing act. That's all. And so with children, you can really see it's almost as if, I mean, if our mothers, look at the parents who beat their kids. It's almost you can say there isn't much attachment. There's a lot of aversion. So almost, thank goodness, our mothers have attachment for us. Do you see what I'm saying? So attachment, one of the characteristics of attachment is that it sees the object, the child, the lover, the cake, as so delicious. So just as well, if my mother saw my, you know, when I was shitting and being revolting and shouting and screaming, but she just saw me as gorgeous, I'm glad she did. She would have chucked me out otherwise. So it's almost like a bit of a, you know, I'm not trying to say, do you see my point? And of course, there's this enormous affection there for children, isn't there? I can see, I mean, it's very obvious, every mother for her child. You recognize the affection, but you look at that child, you know it's not yours. You know, definitely, because you don't have that affection coming. So this enormous affection that arises. And that isn't necessarily attachment. That's just because of enormous familiarity with that being, very strong karma, you know. You just see this ugly little thing. Everybody else sees ugly, but you just this beautiful person, you know. And this is wonderful. This is called affection. There's nothing wrong with affection. That's great. Love is incredible. Love is the wish that child be happy. That's amazing. But when they don't do what you want, and you get irritable, then you know that wasn't the love. That was the attachment. That's the sign for yourself, you know. Or, you know, when the anger arises, you know what I mean? That's when you know it's attachment. Or when you feel this kind of the mind, the heart beating faster, and you kind of get... I mean, the anger can sometimes be very genuinely compassionate because you use skillful means, you know, no more chocolate. Which we have to learn to see ourselves, to discriminate between the neurotic states of mind that are coming from your misery, or whether it's genuinely for the benefit of the person. So it's just an ongoing job. This is your job. That's your practice. You know, I'm a nun. You're a wife. I mean, such a total identity, I know, but your practice is having him, you know. I didn't want one, so I became a nun instead. I found it too hard at practice, quite frankly. We just got to choose one. What? It's tough practice, for sure. I think it's a miracle. I think two people living together... Oh! But really, I really do admire people who can live in a... And I'm being stupid now. I genuinely admire people who can be in an intensely close relationship with a human being and live their life with them and live in the same bed with them and share everything. And I mean, for me, it's asking for trouble, really. I'm not trying to be cynical. I'm really not. I think it's extraordinary if people can grow from that and can become patient and loving and kind. Because every moment is an opportunity. I think as a parent, it's the same. Every moment is an opportunity for madness or for the opposite, you know. So it's extraordinary, I think, if people can do it. Fantastic. Because the bottom line is the same job, whether you're a monk or a nun or a... The job is the same, just the environment's different. The circumstances are different. Yeah. But this is where really, just really to make the point again, it's like the super emotion inside us. And we all just think, well, this is me. We never really know why I get miserable, why I get happy. All we're talking about here is having the ability to discriminate more and more accurately what's arising in you as it arises, being skillful. Just like you would if you had to weed the garden. The flowers and the herbs and everything all look the same when you're not a gardener. I just see a big bath of green stuff. Do you understand? So you learn the theory of botany. So then when you look now, oh, that's a herb, that's a flower, that's a weed. You can really begin to discriminate. But unless you had the theory, you can look in your garden till doomsday. You'll never see the difference. So it's the same. You've got to have a theory that you use as your basis for kind of gardening your own mind. You know? You've got to know what you're seeing there and how to call what's there. That's what the job is, you know. That's just a skill that takes time. And it doesn't often, I mean, you can be calling yourself a Buddhist for 20 years, but unless you begin to really do it, you'll never learn to see your mind. You can label yourself a Buddhist as long as you like. You've got to do the work, you know. And that means listening. If you're saying you're a Buddhist, listening to Buddha's views of the mind. You know, if you accept those views as the ones you want to use, and that's your choice, then you use those ones. Well, attachment is this, anger is this, jealousy is that. It sort of sounds very clinical. But like anything, when you have to learn botany, it's all very clinical. It doesn't seem to have much relationship to that beautiful garden. But you know, it's the ability to recognize this and this and this that causes you to get that beautiful garden in the end. You know? Do you see what I mean? So we don't often think this way as being spiritual, but this is the Buddhist approach, having this kind of clarity in it. Slow and slow. I can chat away if you like. Is it time? Is it time to go though? Is it 8:30? Are we on the 2? Is it time to go? Probably time to go. Cliff, you have not said a word tonight, Cliff. What's wrong? Yeah. Oh, good. So you're thinking, that's good. I understand. That's the idea, I understand. That's true. No, I can see the same for myself, having to say it, but I'm really listening too, really. It's like I'm hearing it, you know. And it's just always very refreshing. It's always very, oh yeah, yeah, oh right, yes, yes, where'd that come from? Thank you, okay. So why don't we just finish with a little prayer. It really is a little prayer that's just really saying, may the positive energy that each of us has imprinted in our consciousness from the listening, thinking, contemplating these teachings of the Buddha, and it's energy that's gone into our minds. Don't just think of it as nothing, you know, it's gone in. They're seeds, so may we nourish these seeds and may they grow, no matter how far into the future, but may they grow into the full development of our own marvellous potential. Let's sing a little prayer in Tibetan that sort of says that. Kewa di nyu du dang Lama Sange Trugyurne Trowa Chikyang Malupang Keki Sala Jang chub sem chug rin po che ma ke pa nam ke gyu chig ke pa nyam pa me pa yan gong ne gong du pa wa shu. Okay, thank you everybody very much. Gyawa gyatso. That's it. Perfect. Okay. I know what gyawa means, but gyatso means ocean. There's an ocean of something. Gyawa gyatso. What's gyawa gyatso?
Vast ocean.
Victorious. Oh, very good. Victoria. There you go. Ocean of victory. Yes, that's it. So, thank you, everybody.